I am a proper doctor, trained in psychiatry. Speer's Wealth Management magazine said I see more billionaires than anyone else in the world. And psychopaths are more commonly found in the famous because of certain personality traits that overlap with the need to be famous or the desire for fame. Aspects of personality that help assist in success in some domains can help land people in trouble in other domains. Rates of high sexual encounters in women who score high, then usually what you're looking at is a personality disorder. They'd find a higher rate of borderline personality disorder in female comedians. You're giving me a very funny look. You're saying something so politically incorrect that I'm going to have to pick you up. I'm going to have to distance myself for these deeply politically incorrect remarks. I don't agree with you. People who vote for Trump, what they love to do is find someone else to blame. That is the appeal of populist politicians like Trump and people like Hitler. Stop blaming the world for your problems. You're giving me a funny look, like you don't agree. You think I'm being... Well, easy, Tiger. Hang on a second.
Hello, and welcome to this edition of The Jolly Heretic. I have a very special guest for you today, a guest indeed who, when I was a young boy, I used to watch on the telly, and that is Dr. Raj Pasot, who was a well-known television psychiatrist. And so for those of you that are perhaps in America and aren't so familiar with him, I'd like to ask Raj to tell you a bit about yourself. So Raj, what are the main things that Americans that haven't heard of you might not know about you?
Well, it's hard to believe, but I am a proper doctor. I am medically qualified. I went to medical school here in London at University College London. And then I specialised in psychiatry. I trained in psychiatry at the Bethlehem Royal and Maudsley Hospitals here in South London. These are meant to be the premier postgraduate training institutions and research institutions in psychiatry here in the UK. I was a bit of what a British term coming up, a bit of a SWAT. At university. A SWAT is a term that British public schools, private schools use for someone who studies too hard. So I did a degree in psychology in the middle of medical school. So you could say I'm a qualified psychologist as well as a psychiatrist. I worked clinically and I work in private practice, the centre of private practice here in London, which is Harley Street. I also, for various reasons we can go into, ended up doing a lot of television and radio. I ended up on a very, very popular daytime TV show here in Britain, where I was the agony uncle, I think is the TV term. People would ring in, and it was a live television program with various psychiatric problems, and I would offer advice and help. By the way, your voice is very familiar from back in the day when people used to ring in. I don't know whether you were a regular caller.
Well, no, because I would have been a teenager at the time. I don't think so.
I'm teasing you.
An agony. Yes, I realise. Although that would be going against your hippopotamus oath, wouldn't it?
No, because if you rang in on a TV programme, it's fine, because it's a public...
Oh, is that okay? Oh, yeah, right.
To remind you that your voice is familiar. I also worked for Americans may heard of this institution, Johns Hopkins. I was a research fellow at Johns Hopkins University, and I worked and practiced as a psychiatrist in America, so I have some understanding of the American system. I loved America. I wanted to stay and be a psychiatrist in America. But the problem was Johns Hopkins is in the middle of Baltimore, and it was back then a very violent city. It might still, I think it's less violent now. But I was in the casualty department, the A&E department in Johns Hopkins, seeing patients coming in off the street. And you had to search the patients for guns before you could consult with them. And the thing about Johns Hopkins and Baltimore was you would find guns, quite a lot of guns. And there was a big sign up in the casualty department. I don't know if it's still there now. It was printed by the security department, the security forces that patrol Johns Hopkins. It was a tough job because it was a violent neighborhood. And the sign said something like, "We will return fire if fired upon." So that was the atmosphere in which I was practicing.
So how did you get involved with Richard and Judy and the media and stuff like this?
Well, you have to go back quite a long time. I think it may be 20 years ago now, or even further back than that. There was a famous member of parliament, a politician called Stephen Milligan, I think his name was. And he had been found dead in tragic circumstances, but suggesting he had been taking part in the fetishistic practice. I know we're going to be talking maybe about sexual issues, fetishism, and so on later on. The fetishistic practice he'd been taking part in called autoerotic asphyxia. So in autoerotic asphyxia, people strangle themselves in various different ways to get an enhanced experience of the orgasm. Often they are either taking part in sex with someone else, or it may be a masturbatory activity. But it's a very, actually not that uncommon, believe it or not, although it sounds very, very strange, act.
When they used to hang people by short drop hanging, they used to ejaculate, didn't they?
Yes, yes. What often happens is people are strangling themselves in the privacy of their own room. And they, unfortunately, because it's a very high risk and dangerous thing to do, what happens is accidents occur and the thing goes too far and they strangle themselves. And this was a phenomenon well known to psychiatrists, but not known to the public. And the journalists were completely befuddled. They'd never heard of anything like this before. And the diagnosis was in the newspapers. And the newspapers rang up the Daily Mail, I think it was, a famous newspaper, the press department of the hospital I was working at, and asked for someone to explain autoerotic asphyxia. So I was commissioned to write an article about what autoerotic asphyxia was, which I did. And Richard and Judy, completely unknown to me, I'd never heard of daytime television, the hosts, married hosts of this famous daytime TV show, read my article the next day and thought to themselves in typical daytime TV phone-in fashion, they thought to themselves, why don't we do a phone-in on fetishes and perversions at 10:30 in the morning? So they invited me up onto their program, and I handled the calls in a way that they found, how should I put this, interesting, because I'm a slightly robust character. I'm not a typical psychiatrist in the way that I answer questions or offer advice. And from that moment onwards, they kept asking me to come back. And I was on the program for, I think, approaching 20 years, I think.
Something tells me it was 1994 or 5 when that happened,
yes,
if I remember
correctly. Yes.
Yeah. And interestingly, of course, it wasn't like now. I mean, there were, one of the things I discussed on this channel is political correctness. There weren't many Asians on TV then.
Actually, there were very, very few. In fact, I was the very first. I'm glad you brought that up, actually. I think it's interesting you brought that up and observed that. I was the very first Asian doctor on British television, and I was the very first Asian doctor to be giving advice to the nation on television. So you could say I became the very first, in a way, well, I was the very first psychiatrist, black or white, Asian or whatever, actually on television in the UK. There had been radio psychiatrists before, but never someone on television in the way that I was. Certainly I was the very first Asian psychiatrist. And there is something back then to think about, groundbreaking, about someone like me giving advice to the whole nation, you know. And I think people became colorblind, as I think they are now. But they weren't back then, I can assure you.
No, they weren't back then. And the people weren't over-promoted because they were non-white back then. If anything, they were the opposite. So
yes,
it was quite, I suppose it was quite, yes, quite an achievement to be born in 1963 or whenever it is you were born.
Yes, I was born in 63, yes.
To be on telly, what would you have been, 93, early 30s, doing that. Now, that segues me into, though, that presumably because of that, you presumably would have met quite a lot of celebrities in the green room, things like this. And I think I've heard you say that you got into some of your patients ended up themselves being celebrities.
Yes. I became famous, if I can call myself that. And B, I met lots of celebrities in the green room, and they weren't used to meeting an actual qualified psychiatrist. They were used to meeting people and the word, you know, call themselves therapists, and that word covers a multitude of sins. And as a result, they would often come and see me and consult with me. But also because I became famous and I wrote many best-selling books, people came to see me through that route. But certainly, I ended up seeing a large number of famous people. The thing that's interesting about psychiatry is, let's say, a senior banker at Goldman Sachs, let me just pick that as an example, and there are many other banks, and people come to see me from other banks, but I'll just pick that as an example. What's really interesting is you start seeing someone from Goldman Sachs, and what happens unbeknownst to you is they start recommending you to their close friends, and all of a sudden you've got like 5 people from Goldman Sachs turn up, and you're thinking to yourself, how come all these people from Goldman Sachs are coming? And that's because of this word of mouth and personal recommendation thing that's going on. And with famous people, it's the same thing. You see a famous Hollywood actor, and then he recommends you to other famous Hollywood actors, and gradually the thing spreads in terms of word of mouth recommendation. There is something very moving, by the way, about people making a personal recommendation to a friend over a psychiatrist. It's easy to make a recommendation over a good dentist at a dinner party if someone says, can you recommend someone, or a good architect, or even a good lawyer. But psychiatrist, to recommend someone means you're confiding that you did actually go and see this person, because people can work it out if you know that someone's good. And I think that's really quite moving that people are prepared. I mean, there's still a stigma attached to seeing a psychiatrist.
Like recommending a good prostitute. There's a stigma attached, and you've done it.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
But more qualified, more qualified. Highbrow.
Yeah, the second oldest profession, I believe. But anyway.
Yeah, perhaps so. So you got to know all of these celebrities. And of course, I've written various books on this. I've got a book coming out soon on James Watson, the guy that co-discovered DNA. I've got a book coming out soon on a chap called Jonathan Bowden, who seems to be a cult figure on the sort of alt-right or something. They're not representative of the population. People that become famous or let's say geniuses, that's what I've looked into a lot, the psychology of a genius. There's a very interesting paper on this. It's called Creativity and Psychopathology by Felix Post in the British Journal of Psychiatry.
Yes. I knew Felix Post. He worked at the same hospital as me, the Bethlehem Royal and the Maudsley. I met him.
Oh, I was constantly citing his paper. I think that paper's great. Fascinating stuff. Well, what was he like?
A very bright man, very busy. A very good psychiatrist, very clinically. Because, I mean, a lot of people who can write papers and do research, because it was a research hospital, aren't very good with the patients. And he was very good with the patients. So it's very unusual to do both, I think.
Anyway, what he found was elevated levels of psychopathy among great people, and also elevated levels of all kinds of other associated markers, sexual dysfunction and perversions and all kinds of things. And one of the things that's been discussed, well, it was started to be discussed around about 2011 with the death of Jimmy Savile, was this notion that people who are sexual abusers, essentially, are elevated, seemingly. I mean, I don't know if they statistically are, but there just seems to be a lot of people in positions of power. You know, it comes out. Maybe it's just because they're in positions of power. Maybe it's representative. I don't know. But if they're high in psychopathy or narcissism, maybe you can see it. Elevate among people that are prominent. You know, there's been so many cases of it. Jimmy Savile, obviously, Hugh Edwards, Philip Schofield, and many, many others. And I was wondering about is if there, is there something about the psychological correlates of extreme success that also militate in favour of paedophilia or abuse or whatever?
Yes, okay, but I think we've got to start being a little bit precise with language here. Okay, so there's fame, like a famous Hollywood actor. Then there is extreme wealth, like someone being a billionaire. And many very wealthy people are not necessarily famous, okay? Spears Wealth Management magazine said in one of their articles about me and psychiatry of wealthy people that they think I see more billionaires than anyone else in the world. And that may be true, but I want to emphasize, I see a lot of ordinary people as well, but obviously I see some famous people for reasons we've described, and I see some very wealthy people. And we've got to make a distinction between what kind of person we're talking about. But let's just focus on famous
what I meant
people.
Was famous. Yes. The Phoenix Press, prominent people.
Yes. But there's a contamination that, generally speaking, famous people tend to have money as well. There's a contamination point there. Okay. So I'll be referring just to famous people or wealthy people, because there's obviously an overlap.
Now, I mean, I suppose you don't get that many people that are famous, but well, you do get people that are famous because they're a criminal or famous. I don't know. Eminent famous people. I guess not all of them are going to be rich. But
yes. Okay. But there are several factors to think about. You're absolutely right that the kind of person who becomes famous, generally speaking, has got a very different personality to the average person, particularly because fame is a difficult thing to achieve, generally speaking. So you have to be someone who is relentlessly, tenaciously pursuing something. In other words, someone who's driven, okay, ambitious. So there's a drive factor involved. OK, and that drive factor you may find at the top of most companies, let's say, or people who are very good at something. Maybe there's a very good tennis player at your local tennis club. Maybe he's the best tennis player in the club, but he won't be the best player by accident. He'll be driven and he'll therefore work very hard at something. So one factor to think about is many of us may walk into a bar and fancy a very attractive member of the opposite sex or same sex at the bar. But because we're not driven people and we're more inhibited, we won't have the guts to go up and chat that person up. Driven people will. Okay, so driven people pursue everything more than the average person. The average person may have sexual appetites, but that doesn't mean they pursue it in a driven way. Okay, but people who are driven and become TV presenters and become famous for all sorts of reasons are more driven. And then the next factor I want to link to that is they are less inhibited. By definition, they are bold. They are assertive. The rest of us are a bit more inhibited. We may see a gorgeous person in a bar, but for various reasons, we're very unlikely to go and approach them. So the lack of inhibition, the added drive, means that in the arena of sex, since we're going to be discussing that, one factor that may lead them into trouble in the realm of sex is their tendency to pursue things in a way the rest of us might be a bit more cautious. Now, the other thing about the caution factor is that in being more cautious, it takes more a longer time for us to warm up to someone or for someone to warm up to us. We may be at the tennis club and play tennis with a drop-dead gorgeous person who we fancy like crazy, but it will take many, many tennis games before we have the guts to make an approach of some description. Famous people tend to be more impulsive, okay, going back to the drive and the lack of inhibition, and that's a personality feature of some aspects that you find more in famous people, like psychopathy. Psychopaths are more commonly found in the famous because of certain personality traits that overlap with the need to be famous or the desire for fame. But one key element of psychopathy, which people neglect, is impulsiveness. So you can begin to see now that if you're a bit impulsive, you're a bit bold, you're a bit assertive, you're a bit driven, you will end up in much more sexual entanglements whereby you could end up in trouble. If it takes you a long time to pluck up the courage to chat someone up, you've got to know them over a long period of time, and you've got a sense of whether they're really that interested in you, what kind of person they are. What we've heard with many celebrities, the stories that have turned out, you can say the names for legal reasons, I've got to be more careful as a doctor. You've heard encounters that are often very brief, like the makeup lady will be making someone up, and then there'll be a very brief interaction, and then there'll be a sexual engagement, you know, within minutes sometimes of the famous person being in the room, and that's more prone to trouble. You can see that it may be the makeup lady wanted you to make an approach, or maybe they didn't. But with a famous person, they often get away with it for a long time, and they begin to believe that everyone's up for it. So you can begin to see a cluster of factors that could lead. There are many other factors. I'm just outlining some of the.
Reminds me a little bit of the stuff that I've done on Genius, and well, others have as well. I don't know if you know Gregory Feist, but various people have looked into Genius, which is the normal range. The person that's the normal plodding scientist, he is mentally stable. He is high in agreeableness, so he's humble and he takes in knowledge, and he's conscientious, so he's careful and he works hard and whatever. And he doesn't need anything original. He just gets stuff other people have done, adds a bit on the end, like research, that is. Whereas the genius, new ideas offend against vested interests. A lot of things are unthinkable if they're the current dogma. But if you're low in impulse control, then you're low in rule following, so you can think outside the box, you can come up with an original idea. If you're low in agreeableness, then you either don't care that your new idea offends, or you're too autistic to understand it's going to offend. If you're high in neuroticism, mental instability, then you're constantly thinking and mulling things over, and the world is unstructured chaos for you, and you want to structure it. And if you're high in extroversion, then you get an incredible buzz out of solving your problem. You know, it really always really does something for you. I mean, when Jim Watson discovered the structure of DNA, he talked about just lying on the bed in almost a sort of a happy coma for hours, just staring at the ceiling. So these kinds of people, I suppose, you can see those traits militate in favour of aspects of psychopathy, i.e. low impulse, not being a very nice person.
Yeah, but let's pick up on the agreeableness point, because agreeableness is the word that psychologists use, and often it sounds a bit old-fashioned and difficult to understand. But the opposite of agreeableness being what we might call bloody-mindedness, right? The willingness to entertain irritating other people in the pursuit of your goal. So I think bloody-mindedness is the word that I would use for the opposite end of agreeableness, is quite a common feature in successful people, because they have to push themselves forward, they have to be bold, they have to speak up at meetings and companies and etc., and they have to not care about offending. So here's an interesting statistic. In Europe, the country that has the highest average IQ is, I'm going to ask you to guess.
Well, I know because I've researched it. It's Finland.
Very good. And do they have
I discovered that.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, do they have the highest number of Nobel Prize winners?
Of course, the lowest.
Yes.
Of course.
Exactly. So why?
You read my paper. We corresponded 10 years ago on this.
Yes. So I'm bringing it up.
Why?
So the theory that would explain that is the Finns are too nice. They're high IQ, but they're too nice. And what you need to be a Nobel Prize winner is a certain bloody-mindedness in order to actually get the Nobel Prize, to not care about the fact your idea, which is a new idea, runs against vested interests. So there is something about certain personality types. And I think the really interesting territory here is aspects of personality that help assist in success in some domains can help land people in trouble in other domains.
Interestingly, it's actually in some ways more subtle than that. Sometimes you'll get a person like a Finn and they'll come up with an idea and they won't realize its significance. So they were, for example, the person that invented the text message was a Finn that worked for Nokia. He had no idea how important it was. It was an American working for a car home warehouse or something that realized the brilliance of this. So you get things like that as well. Yes, so there's a psychopathy involved. So that means that you won't mind hurting people. You'll quite like dominating people. Maybe you quite like hurting people.
Yeah.
But why would you? It's interesting that a lot of these cases that have emerged is things like underage girls. How theoretically, almost in some cases, almost like a fetish. Children, I guess. How does that relate to these traits?
Okay, so we've got to go back to a deeper question, which is why do people want to become famous in the first place? What is the motivating factor? And again, I said we've got to be a bit careful and a bit precise. Some people want to become famous because they associate fame with wealth. So that's not a dissimilar motivation to people in a company wanting to reach the top of the company because they just want to earn more money and they want to have a Ferrari in the garage, okay? But some people want to become famous for other reasons, and some might say darker reasons. And one reason is that they notice that when you're famous, people throw themselves at you. So if you have a nefarious already appetite for, let's say, sexual encounters, and you're not famous, you discover it's pretty hard work quite a lot of the time in bars, etc. But then you notice that if you become famous, and many famous men have talked about this phenomenon, you discover that you seem to unlock the secret of the appeal to women and maybe other men as well. What's going on there is you discover that becoming famous gives you access, okay, to something. And the question is that an accident, or is that actually the underlying motivation of why you desired fame? You desired fame because there was a darker motivation all along, which is you notice it was a very seductive thing. People get seduced, and it was a technique or a tool that allows you to seduce lots of people. Now, there's another thing that's going on with fame, which is a darker motivation, which is famous people observe something, which is many social rules don't apply to them. You walk into a restaurant, a high-end restaurant, as a non-famous person and say, I'm terribly sorry, I haven't booked. Could you give us a table? And you will be instantly rebuffed. Okay, if you're George Clooney and you walk into a high-end restaurant and you say, I'm terribly sorry, we haven't booked, you'll get a table. All right. So the rules don't apply to you when you're famous. Okay, you can break the rules again and again and again. And one of the questions is, are some famous people desiring fame because they want to break the rules? They don't like rules and they want to break them and they want to get away with them. You're caught speeding. And if you are Jennifer Lawrence, gorgeous female Hollywood actress, and the police pull you over and they suddenly recognize you're Jennifer Lawrence, your chances of not getting a ticket for speeding escalate dramatically. Okay, so the rules don't apply to you when you're saying
They would definitely accept you paid with the furry checkbook if you were Jennifer Lawrence.
Anyway, my point being, maybe if the rules don't apply to you, there's a group of people who want to break the rules, and that's the real reason why they want
Presumably,
them.
it could be symbiotic. So you get the kind of people that break the rules, which is to some extent the kind of people that become geniuses and prominent people, and then they themselves realize, maybe they're slightly narcissistic. And then they think they're great, they think they're brilliant, they think they are entitled, and they realize, because these women are chucking themselves at them because women sexually select for status, as we know, and so it sort of interacts in a sort of symbiotic way. But that brings me to another thing, though. I suppose with some people, the ones that aren't motivated by wealth, just by fame, and prominence, they would be more kind of narcissistic, wouldn't they? They would be. And then what causes narcissism is often dark, has quite dark underpinnings. So
Yes.
that's a big part of it. Entitlement.
Yes. Yes. So we've got to be slightly careful. You're wielding a lot of terms, which is fine. A lot of people wield them, narcissism, psychopathy. But I'm sorry to be a boring academic. I just feel we've got to be slightly careful about what we mean by these words and try to be precise. So narcissism is a specific term in psychology. You've got a specific meaning to do with an enhanced sense of your own specialness, way beyond the point at which actually it's warranted. So you believe you're a special, desirable, attractive, intelligent person. The next thing that logically follows, if you think you're an amazing human being, is why are you, given you're an amazing human being, still flipping burgers in McDonald's? Why are you not on the billboard next to George Clooney, being a film star, etc., etc.? So you then get to narcissistic rage, i.e., narcissists are often angry because their own sense of self-esteem and overwhelming self-esteem is so far higher than where they find themselves in life that they're annoyed and angry with it. And now we get to a really interesting personality disorder that you mentioned in the preliminary chat before we went on air. That you wanted to talk about, which is borderline personality disorder, which is very interesting. Now, it's interesting to me that we've mentioned psychopathy and narcissism, and another one that we're going to hopefully talk about is Machiavellianism, which I think is really underrated as a factor in personality disorder. Borderline personality disorder isn't as common a term in the press and the media, but statistically speaking, it's actually the commonest personality disorder, okay, which is fascinating to me that again, we don't often discuss it. And a great moment in film history which captures borderline personality disorder is the great film, famous film, Fatal Attraction with Glenn Close and Michael Douglas. So Glenn Close is having an affair with a married man, Michael Douglas, and there's a famous scene about 27 minutes into the film. I think the film was released in 1987, where she's making spaghetti in her flat, he's opening a bottle of wine, and they hear Madame Butterfly, the opera. And he talks about the fact that there's a suicide at the end of Madame Butterfly, and it really scared him and bothered him as a child when he saw the opera for the first time. Then the scene cuts to them in bed, and they've obviously been having their wicked way with each other. And then he has to get up because he's a married man and get to work and get back to his wife. So he gets out of bed, and she's immediately angry and says, "You always leave me," immediately after lovemaking. And that flip from love and attraction to anger to rage is emblematic of borderline personality disorder, but also emblematic of narcissists. Glenn Close is a classic narcissist in the film, in the sense that she thinks she's so beautiful and wonderful. Then why would you this guy be leaving? It's now annoying, or makes you annoyed that the guy would be leaving when you're so drop dead gorgeous. And then there's a lovely borderline personality sort of classic scene, which is that they have a big fight, and I think she tears his shirt in the big fight, and then they try to make up, and she says to him, "If you're going to leave, at least leave nicely." I mean, I'm paraphrasing exactly what the line is, but she has her hands behind her, which is a lovely directorial moment because you're thinking, "What the hell's going on here? Something bad." And then she reaches out to stroke his face, and it turns out she slit her wrists, Right, she went into the bathroom, slit her wrist. So borderline personality disorder is very, very strongly linked with self-harm and suicide. Suicide.
Yes, I understand that 80% of them self-harm and 10% of them kill themselves.
But a lot of self-harming, if people self-harm and repeatedly do it, the most obvious diagnosis is borderline personality disorder. But I just want to finish the film anecdote. There's something really interesting, because the film is very clever, about the Madame Butterfly bit they threw in. I don't think that's an accident, because what Glenn Close has realised, as Michael Douglas has said, the suicide at the end of the opera really affected him. So now she is manipulatively threatening suicide in order to get him not to leave her. So that's a classic personality disorder piece of behaviour.
So effectively, they have all three of the Dark Triad traits. They have Machiavellianism, yes, whereby you manipulate people to control them. They have but they oscillate, though, as I understand it. So they will, you say they will oscillate between what's called splitting, between loving somebody and hating somebody very quickly.
Yes.
So this is emotional dysregulation.
Yeah, but I want to that's why there's been a campaign amongst psychiatrists to rename it, because people don't like the word borderline. They wonder what the word borderline means. Borderline was a term first coined by a psychoanalyst in the 1930s, referring to the idea. And interestingly enough, practically every personality disorder, by the way, was named first by Europeans. The only one that was named first by an American psychoanalyst in the 1930s, is borderline personality disorder. So I don't know what that says about America. But anyway, he referred to borderline as people on the borderline between neurosis, like obsessive compulsive disorder, anxiety, and psychosis, like schizophrenia, delusions, hallucinations. So he thought these people would oscillate between neurosis and psychosis. But this is a very controversial term. And in the modern day, DSM-4, DSM-5, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, people are trying to rename it, not borderline personality disorder, but emotional instability disorder.
I mean, I understand that one of the things that they can do when they get particularly stressed is they can fall into what used to be called, anyway, borderline psychosis, where they become, which is almost like paranoid schizophrenia, really, where they become paranoid about everything around them and they become basically psychotic.
Yes.
And so they can move between being, on the one hand, psychotic and destroying everything, to being narcissistic, to being schizoid and wanting to get the world away from them. And you have this interesting thing about what you said about fame and men, and why it would be that they'd have affairs with high-status men. I understand that they engage this, what's it called? There was a paper that referred to them as their teddy bear person. There's some term this paper used, i.e. they idealized totally this man as their savior. He's perfect. He's their perfect person.
Yeah, then, idealization is a big part of borderline personality. You idealize the person, and so you fall madly in love with them and idealize them. You have unrealistic expectations. Then you hate them because they fall below the standards you set. So the oscillation between love and hate, which Glenn Close captures beautifully in the film. I think it's a very well-written film in terms of understanding certain psychopathology.
Now, before we continue, I'd like to do something rather exciting. I know that you Generation Z people, you want to have read all of the base books, you want to have imbibed all of the most radical and important scientific knowledge, but you don't particularly like reading very much. So what if there was an app that would take those books, summarise them for you, and then read them back to you in less than 25 minutes? Well, fortunately, such an app exists, and that app is called Legion.com. They have, for example, my book, The Past is a Future Country, The Coming Concern, Demographic Revolution, by myself and my friend Ollie Rayner Hills, in which we look at the way that there is clearly going to be a shift based on breeding patterns among the more intelligent back towards us being right-wing, and the return, therefore, of a kind of genetically right-wing society, a kind of neo-Byzantium. And here it is, The Past of the Future Country. And so you don't even have to read the book if you don't want to. This can inject it straight from the phone into your brain box. And if you sign up today with the code TJH, then of course you can get a 10% discount. So Legion.com, sign up now. All the base knowledge from your phone, direct to your brain.
But the point I'm trying to make is that these terms, psychopathy, narcissism, we all have features of each of these within us. We may have a lot of it or not much of it. I think I don't like the diagnostic labels, because I don't think it's helpful to label people or categorize them. But I think what's really useful is to think about the trait, the element within each of us that has a narcissistic element, and to recognize it when it's in play. When I hit a great tennis shot on a tennis court, I play a lot of tennis, and the opponent can't get the ball back. There's a narcissist within me, because everyone goes, oh, that's an amazing shot, Raj. Then I go, I think we should talk about that shot for a bit longer. That is a classic narcissistic statement. But But I think it's helpful to be, for all of us not to use these labels as if that person over there is a psychopath and I'm fine. I think it's more helpful all of us to think about.
There are some that are more extreme and more pronounced than others.
Definitely, yes.
But what I don't understand, they talk about people that have borderline or whatever as having a weak sense of self.
Yes.
Or even fractured. So what does that mean?
Yes, very good. Very good. You've done your research. But that's exactly why the term is unpopular, because people aren't really clear what that means. My experience as a clinician dealing with a lot of people with borderline personality disorder is what that means is they have no real sense of what their goals are in life. They're often completely goalless, like they don't really clear what their career is. They don't often have jobs, and they often move from relationship to relationship. And that is why relationships are so problematic to people with borderline personality disorder, because they're defining their self through the relationship, right? By being in a relationship with someone else, they now have meaning and purpose because the other person has provided that. If you have a job and you have a career and you have hobbies and interests, you play tennis, you have your job at McDonald's, then you don't define your identity if you have no goals, which is what borderline personality disorder people don't have goals. You don't define yourself through a relationship. And that is why their relationships are so intense.
My understanding is that they tend to, the females at least, will tend to have affairs and things. There's a tendency, they're sexual risk takers.
Yes.
So they'll have a relationship, but then they'll get bored and they'll have an affair.
Yes. So rates of high sexual encounters in women, because women tend to have smaller number of sexual encounters compared to men. But if you have women who score high, which is unusual for most women, very high, then usually what you're looking at is a personality disorder. And I know this is a slightly sexist conversation we're having. I'm just reporting what this research literature shows. And generally speaking, a lot of those women are using sex to get validity. They're seeking validity or self-esteem reassurance that they're worthwhile people because they can attract men and lure them into bed or vice versa, that men lure them into bed. But they get reassurance and therefore a sense of self and a sense of identity and a sense of validation in the sexual arena. And that is often the theory about what's happening with women who are more promiscuous than the average woman.
I read a paper where they looked at the nature of the relationships and that they'd have affairs with men that were kind of grandiose narcissists, in that sense, deadly similar to them. But of course, those men weren't going to take their rubbish for long, weren't going to take being devalued and told they were dreadful, so they would dump them. And they would end up with these quite sad men with sort of avoidant personality and depression.
Okay, so the bit we need to talk about is what is it about personality that becomes dysfunctional? Because a narcissist is actually great on a first date. They're very entertaining. There's something about the confidence of a narcissist that is not unappealing or not unattractive. The issue, in my opinion, just my opinion, is not that personality features like psychopathy and narcissism are in themselves bad thing. Too much of it leads to dysfunctionality. And the question is, where does the dysfunctionality come from? So the narcissist who puts himself center stage doesn't take account of or doesn't care enough for the person he's with. And therefore, in a fumbling sexual encounter, is much more likely to perform an assault because he does something without the consent of the other person. And it's a self-centeredness, right, that leads to that problem. So the deeper, more precise question is, where do these personality features land people in trouble? How do they land them in trouble? And they usually land them in trouble in interactions with other people and a tendency to be self-centered, selfish, and not take account of other people. And as a result, they hurt and upset other people.
I see. While we're on borderline personality, I want to come back to the Jimmy Savile type thing in a minute. You said there was a paper which indicated that females that were comedians were elevated in this. Could you elaborate on that?
Yes, there is a little bit of research evidence that female comedians, again, the trouble is that the research is probably a bit dated because female comedians were a bit more unlikely or unusual back in the day. Now they're much more common on television. And I think today you can see as many female comedians as you could see male comedians.
Yeah, but they're not funny. I'm talking about the minority of women that are funny.
You're saying something so politically incorrect that I'm going to
genuinely funny. But that's not many. That's basically Catherine Ryan, Victoria Wood, a handful of others. So
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to distance myself for these deeply politically incorrect remarks. I don't agree with you that women aren't funny. But anyway,
they're saying they're not funny, they're just less funny.
Okay, I think you're being hilarious.
But... you have a minority. Of course I have a man. Small minority of women that are funny. So those women are strange. Those women are unusual in a way that funny men are not. So you'd expect it to be
easy, Tiger. Hang on a second. Amongst male comedians, there are higher rates of personality disorder as well.
Yeah, narcissism, yeah.
Yeah, well, another personality feature. And remember, there's quite a high suicide rate amongst comedians. We could go through a long list, Spike Milligan being one of the people that might started off, right? Robin Williams, again, I think possibly may have killed himself, et cetera, et cetera. So I wouldn't say that comedians themselves are not male devoid of personality problems. It often is a very strong link. One theory about what's going on with comedians is that they struggled in relationships when they were younger, and they learned that being funny was a way to get people to like them, and they therefore mistake the idea that being funny is how you get love and attention. And a lot of comedians, when they come off stage, and I've seen many comedians in my clinical practice, find it an incredible strain that when they meet people in everyday conversation, they're expected to continue to be funny. And when you're not funny, because you're not performing, it's a performance, then people are very disappointed. And so people end up on a kind of treadmill of trying to be funny all the time as a way of having a relationship.
I met Jimmy Carr at a conference, and we were having a serious conversation. I think he's quite funny, but I met him at a conference, and we were having a serious conversation, and it was interesting. He felt the need to throw in a joke.
There we go. See, yeah.
As if it was expected, as if we. I just thought that was completely unnecessary, but very good. And it was like almost like he felt he should. It was a strange thing. But anyway, tell me about the relationship between BPD in women comedians. What's the...
They find a higher rate of borderline personality disorder in female comedians. Exactly the significance of that is difficult to know. We also think that female comedians back in the day maybe had a tougher time, so because they would often get more heckling than male comedians, and it was just much tougher. So maybe you had to be a tougher person to choose it as a profession, or maybe it toughened you up. And maybe there's something about borderline personality disorder in terms of the ability to deal with stress. It leads to a particular reaction to stress that may explain the link. But I'm nervous about the link.
So what reaction to stress is that?
Well, the reaction is, going back to the Glenn Close example, in the Glenn Close example in Fatal Attraction, this person who may and was used in many PhD theses to be emblematic of borderline personality disorder, her way of dealing with insecurity and stress is to attract someone. A female comedian may be using being funny and therefore attracting people as a way of dealing with some kind of internal stress, possibly. But that's a theory that would apply to comedians in general.
What is a joke? In many ways, a joke is making a connection, but juxtaposing things, making a connection between two things that you wouldn't think of were normally connected, and from there, or you're doing something out. It's something is outrageous because you do it in an unexpected situation, and therefore it's funny. So it's connecting two things that are superficially unconnected. And presumably, people that are high in autistic traits, they have a tendency to do that. They systematize. They make connections others don't. They notice details. And I know that there is some kind of relationship among women anyway between autism and borderline personality. And whether that's because people that are autistic get bullied and develop borderline personality, or whether it's because a lot of the traits taking in too much information, oversensitive, strong emotions. But there is apparently a relationship there. And presumably, I could see how that could relate to comedy.
Okay, well, I think you're asking an excellent question by going deeper into what we're discussing and asking a question, what is a joke? And I think it's a really important question. And in fact, there's a separate research literature on laughter. Why do people laugh? And what is it about jokes that make people laugh? And certainly we know that jokes have a punchline, and the structure of a joke is something slightly unexpected happens at the end of the joke. It's not predictable. And we believe that the laughter is a reaction to the unexpectedness. So by definition, people who can make jokes are able to do the unexpected, and there has to be something about their character that liberates them to take risks, because there's a sense in which every joke is a kind of risk. By the way, one of the most unfunny books ever written was written by Sigmund Freud, who wrote a famous book called Jokes and Their Relation to the Unconscious. So he believed there was something about jokes. This is back when the unconscious was a big thing in psychiatry and psychology. It's become a smaller thing now. He believed that why jokes were so interesting was they were telling us something about the unconscious. Now, what's really interesting about Freud is that although he may have got a lot of things wrong, he is the very last, except for maybe the behaviorist like Skinner, he's the last person to try to come up with a theory of everything in psychiatry and psychology. Modern day psychiatrists and psychologists specialize in obsessive compulsive disorder or in something else. No one's coming up with a grand theory of everything, which is what Freud did. Were all his failings, that's really quite an ambitious thing. So, but the problem with the theory of everything was it always came back to something going on in the unconscious. So with female comedians, the theory would be something's going on in the unconscious, which maybe explains why they are turning to humor. And that's what the Freudian analysis would be. We've abandoned the Freudian analysis, but have we lost something really quite interesting in doing that? But it is an interesting book. Freud, people should look it up, Jokes and Their Relation to the Unconscious by Sigmund Freud.
I would expect that women that were good at something that is dominated by men would probably have certain masculinized traits. And autism is masculinizing. In men and women. And so I can see how there might be a connection. But while I'm on autism, there is an association between, as I understand it, autism and sexual fetishes. And because I don't know exactly why they take in more information, they create sexual associations more easily, I don't know. But one of the things that was, of course, noticed during this during this moral panic in the wake of Jimmy Savile and Operation U-Tree and all this, was, I mean, he specifically was attracted to very young girls. And you get others, what was his name, Frank Boff, was that his name? And it was sadomasochism. And as you say, there was this member of parliament, auto-asphyxia. These are fetishes. Now, perhaps, I mean, I don't know if you've read the book A Billion Wicked Thoughts, but perhaps they are less unusual than we like to think. But the impression one gets, particularly something like paedophilia, is it's quite rare, but yet you get all these cases of it among celebrities. So is there something about the kind of person that would become famous that would militate in favour of the development of unusual sexual practices?
Well, again, psychiatrists and psychologists and academics who are trying to understand or answer these questions would say that what you're doing there is you're prone to what's called a reporting bias. In other words, just because it gets reported, because these celebrities, whatever happens to them gets reported, we think there's a high rate of sex abuse, sexual assault, sexual dysfunction in a paedophilic sense, or a high rate of perversions. But really, it's probably the case that there's a high rate of this in the population, but you just don't hear about it because the person down the street who gets arrested for paedophilia doesn't hit the newspapers. So it just appears that there's a link between celebrity and paedophilia, but it doesn't mean there actually is one. But
I want to Felix Post's paper, then he did note that there were elevated levels of sexual dysfunction and sexual deviance and whatever among his sample compared to the general population.
Yeah, but you've always got the problem of the reporting bias, which is how do you know what the denominator is? How do you know for absolute certainty, unless you have a study where you use exactly the same instrument that measures paedophilia, let's say, in the 100,000 members of the public and 100 celebrities, unless you have exactly the same instrument that's measuring this thing, how would you know? So I think there's a question mark over the conclusion. However, there are some theories in psychology and psychiatry that would explain why there might be a link. And one possibility of why there might be a link is simply going back to the point I've made earlier about access. Jimmy Savile, if he wasn't famous, may have craved some kind of sexual encounter with young people, but not being famous would have meant he would have had no access, okay? Because he becomes famous and is presenting shows where lots of young people are on the set, he now has access. And also those young people may be throwing themselves at him, or perhaps more pertinently, their parents of the young people might be throwing themselves at Jimmy Savile. And because they want access to Jimmy Savile, they don't mind it when Jimmy Savile says, could your 9-year-old daughter come and be with me in the dressing room for various innocent reasons he may come up with, and they may turn a blind eye. So celebrity and fame may give you access, and also it may mean that when people think there could be something dodgy going on, and this certainly what partly happened in the Jimmy Savile case, partly happened, is that people turn a blind eye, because should they see the blindingly obvious in front of him, and I think one of the headlines of the reports about Jimmy Savile was hiding in plain sight. If they would see the blindingly obvious, a lot of catastrophes would occur in terms of ratings, in terms of TV programs being axed, in terms of channels not being successful. So one of the things that's going on with celebrities is a famous psychological phenomenon called the halo effect. Because we like the celebrity, they're funny, we warm towards them. The halo effect says we attribute other positive qualities to them. We think they're trustworthy. We think they wouldn't molest little girls, for example. But that halo effect may make us blind to other things that are going on. And that leads directly to the most provocative point of all. Are some people attracted to fame because it allows them to hide in plain sight? I'm sorry to bring up a really contentious example, but the Catholic Church is a very good example. The film Spotlight highlighted the scandal of Catholic priests abusing little boys in church. And one of the reasons the Catholic priests got away with it and may have been drawn to the Catholic Church is precisely because it provided the perfect cover. People didn't think it would be happening in the Catholic Church.
Yes, there was a, this is, I wrote a book some years ago called Churchill's Headmaster, and it was about Herbert Snaid Kinnersley, who was his prep school headmaster, and was almost certainly a non-active pederast. There was a case, I think you're from Reading, aren't you, or connected to Reading? Mm-hmm. And there was a case about 2011, it was, in Reading Crown Court, in which a secondary school teacher was found guilty of downloading child porn or something like that. And the judge, I believe her name was Mary Lovat, said, look, lots of school teachers are attracted to school children, and that's why they go into teaching. But they keep their proclivities under wraps, you know, and they don't do things like you've done. You've crossed a line. You've essentially commissioned sexual abuse, and I'm going to have sentenced you to a custodial sentence. And the teachers' unions, oh God, it was the ultimate in denial. They were in uproar. You know, teachers are professional people that want to help young minds, and the idea that you could suggest that they could have any untoward reason for going, and you know, of course they bloody do. The very idea. That if you're a bit of a nonce, you're not going to be attracted, and you're reasonably intelligent. I mean, I then found looking into it, there were studies on this. They are doing what Jimmy Savile is doing on a much smaller scale.
Yeah, but hang on a second. I've got to draw an important distinction between another very important point now we're discussing, which is it possible that many, many, many more people than end up performing an act have a desire, right, have a thought, have an emotion, right, but never cross the line of performing the act, okay?
Clearly.
So, and I agree, that's probably the case. In which case, are they really guilty of anything? If no one has been harmed because they never perform an act, they entertain thoughts, okay? Does that mean make them guilty of something? So the question is, in the law's eyes, they're not guilty because they haven't broken the law. The law requires an act, usually. The question is, why do people cross that line into an act, okay? And one of the answers is their analysis about their probability of being caught. And a lot of them are highly intelligent, manipulative, psychopaths, etc. And they calculate they're not going to get caught, or they don't think they're going to get caught. And what is that calculation based on? If you're a teacher, you may be a person of high status, you're meant to hang out with children anyway, you'll get away, perhaps, the teacher thinks, with touching children in an appropriate way because I'm a teacher, etc., etc., etc. So a lot of people who end up committing crimes have come up with analysis about how likely am I to get caught and have thought their way through how to avoid being caught, and that's why they cross that line. Okay, so it's a crossing of that line that's really significant.
What is it that leads to? With plausible deniability. Oh, you know, I was just checking. I was just, it's like in that episode of Brass Eye, where he was touching the child's penis at a time. Yes, he was trying to save him from a fly. And it's that plausible deniability which they...
That's certainly one set of theories, but another one is to be really likable. If people really, really like you, they trust you and they turn a blind eye. That building up of trust and like, which is what celebrities do. Celebrities are used to endorse the selling of cars, the selling of toothpaste, etc., etc., because they are ultimately, and there's a theory in psychology that celebrities become a new religion, and people worship celebrities, right? So what's happening now is celebrities are the place where people go to for advice about how to deal with bowel cancer. If you're a bowel cancer charity, what you really need is not a doctor who's an expert on bowel cancer. You need a celebrity who's had bowel cancer to talk about it, to attract attention and to get ideas over.
You said earlier that you've become reasonably prominent, you get to know other prominent people, whatever, and to a limited degree, perhaps my YouTube channels help me in that regard. So I know lots of people. I certainly know people that know people. And you start to hear rumours about very prominent and powerful and famous people in this country that would make your nose bleed. I mean, like, you can't come out and say it, or they'll sue you. But independent sources are all saying the same thing. Hmm. And you think, bloody hell. And in one case, I investigated it myself and got documents, which, as far as I could say, prove my point, I'm not going to say what it is, but about someone very powerful. Hmm. And so this makes one thing, going back to what we were talking about at the beginning, that there's a degree to which, most unfortunate, I know my...
Are you ready for the future of the West?